Chapter 60. Trash Can Man had what he wanted. He came along a hallway deep underground, a hallway as dark as a mine pit. In his left hand, he held a flashlight. In his right hand, he held a gun, because it was spooky down here. He was riding an electric tram that rolled almost silently along the wide corridor. The only sound it made was a low, almost sub-aural hum. Resting in the carry space was an atomic warhead. It was heavy. Trash could not make an intelligent guess as to just how heavy it was, because he hadn't even been able to budge it by hand. It was long and cylindrical. It was cold. Running his hand over its curved surface, he had found it hard to believe that such a cold, dead lump of metal could have the potential for so much heat. He had found it at 4 in the morning. He had gone back to the motor pool and had gotten a chainfall. He had brought the chainfall back down and had rigged it over the warhead. 90 minutes later, it was nestled cozily into the electric tram, nose up. Stamped on the nose was A16410 USAF. The hard rubber tires of the tram had settled appreciably when he put it in. Now he was coming to the end of the hallway. Straight ahead was the large freight elevator with its doors standing invitingly open. It was plenty big enough to take the tram, but of course there was no electricity. Trash had gotten down by the stairs. He had brought the chainfall down the same way. The chainfall was light compared to the warhead. It only weighed 100 pounds or so, and still it had been a chore getting it down 5 courses of stairs. How was he going to get the warhead up those stairs? Power-driven winch, his mind whispered. Sitting on the driver's seat and shining his flash randomly around, Trash nodded to himself. Sure, that was the ticket. Winch it up. Set a motor topside and pull it up, stair riser by stair riser if he had to. But where was he going to find 500 feet of chain all in one piece? He hopped down and ran a caressing hand over the smooth, deadly surface of the warhead in the silent darkness. Love would find a way. Leaving the warhead in the tram, he began to climb the stairs again to see what he could find. A base like this, there would be a little of everything. He would find what he needed. He climbed 2 flights and paused to catch his breath. He suddenly wondered, "Have I been taking radiation?" They shielded all that stuff, shielded it with lead. But in the movies you saw on TV, the men who handled radioactive stuff were always wearing those protective suits and film badges that turned color if you got a dose. Because it was silent. You couldn't see it. It just settled into your flesh and your bones. You didn't even know you were sick until you started puking and losing your hair. Was that going to happen to him? He discovered that he didn't care. He was going to get that bomb up. Somehow he was going to get it up. Somehow he was going to get it back to Las Vegas. He had to make up for the terrible thing he had done at Indian Springs. If he had to die to atone, then he would die. "My life for you," he whispered in the darkness, and began to climb the stairs again. Chapter 61. It was nearly midnight on the evening of September 17th. Randall Flagg was in the desert, wrapped in 3 blankets, from toes to chin. A 4th blanket was swirled around his head in a kind of burnous, so that only his eyes and the tip of his nose were visible. He looked up at the bright desert stars. Little by little, he let all thoughts slip away. He grew still. The stars were cold fire, witchlight. He sent out the eye. He felt it separate from himself with a small and painless tug. It went flying away, silent as a hawk rising on dark thermals. Now he had joined with the night. He was eye of crow, eye of wolf, eye of weasel, eye of cat. He was the scorpion, the strutting trapdoor spider. He was a deadly poison arrow, slipping endlessly through the desert air. Flying effortlessly, the world of earthbound things spread out below him like a clock face. They're coming. They're almost in Utah now. He flew high, wide, and silent over a graveyard world. Below him the desert lay like a whited sepulcher cut by the dark ribbon of the interstate highway. He flew east, over the state line now, his body far behind, glittering eyes rolled up to blind whites. Now the land below began to change, buttes and strange wind-carved pillars and tabletop mesas. The highway ran straight through. The Bonneville Salt Flats lay to the far north. Skull Valley somewhere west. Flying. The sound of the wind, dead and distant. An eagle poised in the highest crotch of an ancient lightning-blasted pine somewhere south of Richfield felt something pass close by, some deadly sighted thing whizzing through the night. And the eagle took wing against it, fearless, and was buffeted away by a grinning sensation of deadly cold. The eagle fell almost all the way to the ground, stunned, before recovering itself. The dark man's eye went east. Now the highway below was I-70. The towns were huddled lumps, deserted except for the rats and the cats and the deer that had already begun to creep in from the forests as the scent of man washed away. Towns with names like Fremont and Green River and Seago and Thompson and Harley Dome. Then a small city, also deserted. Grand Junction, Colorado. Then, just east of Grand Junction, was a spark of campfire. The eye spiraled down. The fire was dying. There were four figures sleeping around it. It was true then. The eye appraised them coldly. They were coming. For reasons he could not fathom, they were actually coming. Nadine had told the truth. Then there was a low growling, and the eye turned in another direction. There was a dog on the far side of the campfire, its head lowered, its tail coiled down and over its privates. Its eyes glowed like baleful amber gems. Its growl was a constant thing, like endlessly ripping cloth. The eye stared at it, and the dog stared back, unafraid. Its lip curled back, and it showed its teeth. One of the forms rose to a sitting position. "Kojak," it mumbled. "Will you, for Christ's sake, shut up?" Kojak continued to growl, his hackles up. The man who had awakened, it was Glenn Bateman, looked around, suddenly uneasy. "Who's there, boy?" he whispered to the dog. "Is something there?" Kojak continued to growl. "Stu!" He shook the form next to him. The form muttered something and was silent again. He had seen enough. He whirled upward, catching just a glimpse of the dog's neck craning up to follow him. The low growl turned into a volley of barks, loud at first, then fading, fading, gone. Silence and rushing darkness. Some unknown time later, he paused over the desert floor, looking down at himself. He sank slowly, approaching the body, then sinking into himself. For a moment, there was a curious sensation of vertigo, of two things merging into one. Then the eye was gone, and there was only his eyes, staring up at the cold and gleaming stars. They were coming, yes. Flagg smiled. Had the old woman told them to come? Would they listen to her if she, on her deathbed, instructed them to commit suicide in that novel way? He thought it was possible that they would. What he had forgotten was so staggeringly simple that it was humbling. They were having their problems, too. They were frightened, too. And as a result, they were making a colossal mistake. They were coming wrapped in righteousness like a clutch of missionaries approaching the cannibals' village. Oh, it was lovely. Doubts would end. Fears would end. All it would take was the sight of their foreheads up on spikes in front of the MGM Grand's fountain. He would assemble every person in Vegas and make them file past and look. He would have photographs taken, would print flyers, have them sent out to L.A. and San Francisco and Spokane and Portland. Five heads. He would put the dog's head up on a pole, too. "Good doggy," Flagg said, and laughed aloud for the first time since Nadine had goaded him into throwing her off the roof. "Good doggy," he said again, grinning. He slept well that night, and in the morning he sent out word that the watch on the roads between Utah and Nevada was to be tripled. But they were no longer looking for one man going east, but four men and a dog going west. And they were to be taken alive at all costs. Chapter 62. You know, Glenn Bateman said, looking out toward Grand Junction in the early light of morning, I've heard the saying, that sucks, for years, without really being sure of what it meant. Now I think I know. He looked down at his breakfast, which consisted of Morningstar Farms synthetic sausage links, and grimaced. No, this is good, Ralph said earnestly. You should have had some of the chow we had in the army. They were sitting around the campfire, which Larry had rekindled an hour earlier. They were all dressed in warm coats and gloves, and all were on their second cups of coffee. The temperature was about 35 degrees, and the sky was cloudy and bleak. Kojak was napping as close to the fire as he could get without singeing his fur. I'm done feeding the inner man, Glenn said, getting up. Give me your garbage. I'll bury it. Stu handed him his paper plate and cup. This walking's really something, isn't it, Baldy? I bet you ain't been in this good shape since you were 20. Yeah, 70 years ago, Larry said, and laughed. Stu, I was never in this kind of shape, Glenn said grimly, picking up litter and popping it into the plastic sack he intended to bury. I never wanted to be in this kind of shape, but I don't mind. After 50 years of confirmed agnosticism, it seems to be my fate to follow an old black woman's god into the jaws of death. Walking takes longer, consequently I live longer. By a few days, anyway. Excuse me, gentlemen, while I give this rubbish a decent burial. They watched him walk to the edge of the camp with a small entrenching tool. This walking tour of Colorado and points west, as Glenn put it, had been the hardest on Glenn himself. He was the oldest, Ralph Brentner Sr. by 12 years. But somehow he had eased it considerably for the others. His irony was constant but gentle, and he seemed at peace with himself. The fact that he was able to keep going day after day made an impression on the others, even if it was not exactly an inspiration. He was 57, and Stu had seen him working his finger joints on these last 3 or 4 cold mornings, and grimacing as he did it. Hurt bad? Stu had asked him yesterday, about an hour after they had moved out. Aspirin takes care of it. It's arthritis, you know, but it's not as bad as it's apt to be in another 5 or 7 years. And frankly, East Texas, I'm not looking that far ahead. Now they heard him digging at the frozen soil and cursing it. Quite a fella, ain't he? Ralph said. I always thought those college teachers were sissies. Know what he said when I asked him why he didn't just throw that crap to one side of the road? Said we didn't need to start up that kind of shit again. Said we'd started up too many of the old brands of shit already. Kojak got up and trotted over to see what Glenn was doing. Glenn's voice floated over to them. Well, there you are, you big lazy turd. Want me to bury you, too? Larry grinned and took off the myelometer clipped to his belt. He had picked it up in a Golden Sports supply shop. You set it according to the length of your stride and then clipped it to your belt like a carpenter's rule. Each evening, he wrote down how far they had walked that day on a dog-eared and often-folded sheet of paper. Can I see that cheat sheet? Stu asked. Sure, Larry said, and handed it over. Stu looked at Larry's running total. As of this morning, they had come 362 miles from Boulder, according to Larry's myelometer, at least. Shit, he said. We're not even halfway. Larry nodded. But we're making better time now. We're going downhill. And he's right, you know. Why do we want to hurry? Larry's myelometer made 4 distinct little clicks as he set it for the day. 00. Stu doused what remained of the campfire with dirt. The little rituals of the morning went by. They had been 12 days on the road. It seemed to Stu that the days would go on forever like this. Glenn bitching good-naturedly about the food, Larry noting their mileage on his dog-eared cheat sheet, the 2 cups of coffee, someone burying yesterday's scut, someone else burying the fire. It was routine, good routine. You forgot what it was all leading to, and that was good. In the mornings, Fran seemed very distant to him, very clear, but very distant, like a photograph kept in a locket. But in the evenings, when the dark had come and the moon sailed the night, she seemed very close, almost close enough to touch. And that, of course, was where the ache lay. At times like those, his faith in Mother Abigail turned to bitter doubt, and he wanted to wake them all up and tell them it was a fool's errand, that they had taken up rubber lances to tilt at a lethal windmill, that they had better stop at the next town, get motorcycles, and go back, that they had better grab a little light and a little love while they still could, because a little was all that Flagg was going to allow them. But that was at night. In the mornings, it still seemed right to go on. He looked speculatively at Larry and wondered if Larry thought about his Lucy late at night, dreamed about her and wished. Glenn came back into camp with Kojak at his heel, wincing a little as he walked. "Let's go get 'em," he said. "Right, Kojak?" Kojak wagged his tail. "He says Las Vegas or bust," Glenn said. "Come on." They climbed the embankment to I-70, now descending toward Grand Junction, and began their day's walk. Late that afternoon, a cold rain began to fall, chilling them all and damping conversation. Larry walked by himself, hands shoved in his pockets. At first he thought about Harold Lauder, whose corpse they had found 2 days ago. There seemed to be an unspoken conspiracy among them not to talk about Harold, but eventually his thoughts turned to the person he had dubbed the Wolfman. They had found the Wolfman just east of the Eisenhower Tunnel. The traffic was badly jammed up there, and the stink of death had been sickly potent. The Wolfman had been half in and half out of an Austin. He was wearing pegged jeans and a silk-sequined western shirt. The corpses of several wolves lay around the Austin. The Wolfman himself was half in and half out of the Austin's passenger seat, and a dead wolf lay on his chest. The Wolfman's hands were wrapped around the wolf's neck, and the wolf's bloody muzzle was angled up at the Wolfman's neck. Reconstructing, it seemed to all of them that a pack of wolves had come down out of the higher mountains, had spotted this lone man, and had attacked. The Wolfman had had a gun. He had dropped several of them before retreating into the Austin. How long before hunger had forced him from his refuge? Larry didn't know, didn't want to know. But he had seen how terribly thin the Wolfman had been, a week maybe. He had been going west, whoever he was, going to join the Dark Man, but Larry would not have wished such a dreadful fate on anyone. He had spoken of it once to Stu, 2 days after they had emerged from the tunnel, with the Wolfman safely behind them. "Why would a bunch of wolves hang around so long, Stu?" "I don't know. I mean, if they wanted something to eat, couldn't they find it?" "Well, I'd think so, yeah." It was a dreadful mystery to him, and he kept working it over in his mind, knowing he would never find the solution. Whoever the Wolfman had been, he hadn't been lacking in the balls department. Finally, driven by hunger and thirst, he had opened the passenger door. One of the wolves had jumped him and torn his throat out. But the Wolfman had throttled it to death even as he himself died. The four of them had gone through the Eisenhower Tunnel roped together, and in that horrible blackness, Larry's mind had turned to the trip he had made through the Lincoln Tunnel. Only now it was not images of Rita Blakemore that haunted him, but the face of the Wolfman, frozen in its final snarl as he and the wolf had killed each other. Were the wolves sent to kill that man? But that thought was too unsettling to even consider. They made their camp that night close to the Utah line. Supper consisted of forage and boiled water, as all their meals did. They were following Mother Abigail's instructions to the letter. "It's going to get bad in Utah," Ralph remarked. "I guess that's where we're going to find out if God really is watching over us. There's one stretch better than 100 miles without a town or even a gas station and a cafe." He didn't seem particularly disturbed by the prospect. Ralph shrugged. "Guess I'll turn in," he said. Larry followed suit. Glenn stayed up to smoke a pipe. Stu had a few cigarettes and decided to have one. They smoked in silence for a while. "Long way from New Hampshire, Baldy," Stu said at last. "It isn't exactly shouting distance from here to Texas." Stu smiled. "No, no, it ain't. You miss Fran a lot, I guess." "Yeah, miss her, worry about the baby." Glenn puffed. That's nothing you can change, Stuart. I know, but I worry. Sure. Glenn knocked out his pipe on a rock. Something funny happened last night, Stu. I've been trying to figure it out all day, if it was real or a dream or what. What was it? Well, I woke up in the night and Kojak was growling at something. Must have been past midnight because the fire had burned way down. Kojak was on the other side of it with his hackles standing up. I told him to shut up and he never even looked at me. He was looking over to my right, and I thought, what if it's wolves? Ever since we saw that guy Larry calls the Wolf Man. Yeah, that was bad. But there was nothing. I had a clear view. He was growling at nothing. He had a scent, that's all. Yeah, but the crazy part is still to come. After a couple of minutes, I started to feel, well, decidedly weird. I felt like there was something right over by the turnpike embankment, and that it was watching me, watching all of us. I felt like I could almost see it, that if I squinted my eyes the right way, I would see it. But I didn't want to, because it felt like him. Probably nothing, Glenn, Stu said after a moment. It sure felt like something. It felt like something to Kojak, too. Well, suppose he was watching somehow. What could we do about it? Nothing, but I don't like it. It scares me shitless. Even more than, well, finding Harold that way. Blew his own head off. Christ Jesus. Glenn grimaced sourly and rubbed his sore knees. Stu nodded. That was nothing but a waste. A waste of Nick and Sue and of himself, too. I agree. They had come upon Harold and his pitiful dying declaration the day after they had done the Eisenhower Tunnel. He and Nadine must have gone over Loveland Pass because Harold still had his Triumph cycle, the remains of it anyway. And as Ralph had said, it would have been impossible to get anything bigger than a kid's little red wagon through the Eisenhower. The buzzards had worked him over pretty well. The .38 was jammed in his mouth like a grotesque lollipop, and although they hadn't buried Harold, Stu had removed the pistol. He had done it gently. Seeing how efficiently the dark man had destroyed Harold and how carelessly he had thrown him aside when his part was played out, had made Stu hate Flag all the more. It made him feel that they were throwing themselves away in a witless sort of children's crusade. And while he felt that they had to press on, Harold's corpse with the shattered leg haunted him the way the frozen grimace of the Wolf Man haunted Larry. He had discovered he wanted to pay Flag back for Harold as well as Nick and Susan. But he felt more and more sure that he would never get that chance. But you want to watch out, he thought grimly. You want to look out if I get within choking distance of you, you freak. Glenn got up with a little wince. I'm going to turn in, East Texas. Don't beg me to stay. It really is a dull party. How's that arthritis? Glenn smiled and said, not too bad. But as he crossed to his bedroll, he was limping. Stu thought he should not have another cigarette. Only smoking two or three a day would exhaust his supply by the end of the week. And then he lit one anyway. This evening it was not so cold, but for all that there could be no doubt that in this high country, at least, summer was done. It made him feel sad, because he felt very strongly that he would never see another summer. When this one had begun, he had been an on-again, off-again worker at a factory that made pocket calculators. He had spent a lot of his spare time hanging around Hap's station, listening to the other guys shoot the shit about the economy, the government, hard times. Stu guessed that none of them had known what real hard times were. He finished his cigarette and tossed it into the campfire. Keep well, Franny, old kid, he said, and got into a sleeping bag. And in his dreams, he thought that something had come near their camp, something that was keeping malevolent watch over them. It might have been a wolf with human understanding, or a crow, or a weasel creeping belly down through the scrub, or it might have been some disembodied presence, a watching eye. I will fear no evil, he muttered in his dream. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. No evil. At last the dream faded, and he slept soundly. The next morning they were on the road again early, Larry's mileometer clicking off the miles as the highway switched lazily back and forth down the gentling western slope toward Utah. Shortly after noon, they left Colorado behind them. That evening, they camped west of Harley Dome, Utah. For the first time, the great silence impressed them as being oppressive and malefic. Ralph Brentner went to sleep that night thinking, "We're in the West now. We're out of our ballpark and into his." And that night, Ralph dreamed of a wolf with a single red eye that had come out of the Badlands to watch them. "Go away," Ralph told it. "Go away. We're not afraid. Not afraid of you." By 2 p.m. on the afternoon of September 21st, they were past Sego. The next large town, according to Stu's pocket map, was Green River. There were no more towns after that for a long, long time. "Actually," Larry said to Glenn, "I'm not as worried about food as I am water. Most everyone who's on a trip keeps a few munchies in their car, Oreos or Fig Newtons or something like that." Glenn smiled. "Maybe the Lord will send us showers of blessing." Larry looked up at the cloudless blue sky and grimaced at the idea. "I sometimes think she was right off her block at the end of it." "Maybe she was," Glenn said mildly. "If you read your theology, you'll find that God often chooses to speak through the dying and the insane. It even seems to me, here's the closet Jesuit coming out, that there are good psychological reasons for it. A madman or a person on her deathbed is a human being with a drastically changed psyche. A healthy person might be apt to filter the divine message, to alter it with his or her own personality. In other words, a healthy person might make a shitty prophet." "The ways of God," Larry said, "I know. We see through a glass darkly. It's a pretty dark glass to me, all right. Why we're walking all this way when we could have driven it in a week." "I see some perfectly sound psychological and sociological reasons for this walk," Glenn said. "I don't know if they're God's reasons or not, but they make good sense to me."
"Such as what?"
Stu and Ralph had walked over to hear this, too. There were several American Indian tribes that used to make having a vision an integral part of their manhood rite. When it was your time to become a man, you were supposed to go out into the wilderness unarmed. You were supposed to make a kill and two songs, one about the Great Spirit and one about your own prowess as a hunter and a rider and a warrior and a fucker, and have that vision. You weren't supposed to eat. You were supposed to get up high and wait for that vision to come. And eventually, of course, it would. He chuckled. "Starvation is a great hallucinogenic."
"You think Mother sent us out here to have visions?" Ralph asked.
"Maybe to gain strength and holiness by a purging process," Glenn said. "The casting away of things is symbolic, you know, talismanic. When you cast away things, you're casting away the self-related others that are symbolically related to those things. You start a cleaning out process. You begin to empty the vessel."
Larry shook his head slowly.
"I don't follow that." "Well, take an intelligent pre-plague man. Break his TV, and what does he do at night?"
"Reads a book," Ralph said.
"Goes to see his friends," Stu said.
"Plays the stereo," Larry said, grinning.
"Sure, all those things," Glenn said. "But he's also missing that TV. There's a hole in his life where that TV used to be. In the back of his mind, he's still thinking, at 9 o'clock, I'm going to pull a few beers and watch the Sox on the tube. And when he goes in there and sees that empty cabinet, he feels as disappointed as hell. A part of his accustomed life has been poured out, is it not so?"
"Yeah," Ralph said. "Our TV went on the fritz once for 2 weeks, and I didn't feel right until it was back."
"It makes a bigger hole in his life if he watched a lot of TV, a smaller hole if he only used it a little bit. But something is gone. Now take away all his books, all his friends, and his stereo. Also remove all sustenance except what he can glean along the way. It's an emptying out process and also a diminishing of the ego. Yourselves, gentlemen, they are turning into window glass, or better yet, empty tumblers."
"But what's the point?" Ralph asked. "Why go through all the rigmarole?"
Glenn said, "If you read your Bible, you'll see that it was pretty traditional for these prophets to go out into the wilderness from time to time. Old Testament magical mystery tours. The time span given for these jaunts was usually 40 days and 40 nights, a Hebraic idiom that really means no one knows exactly how long he was gone, but it was quite a while. Does that remind you of anyone? Sure, Mother, Ralph said. Now think of yourself as a battery. You really are, you know. Your brain runs on chemically converted electrical current. For that matter, your muscles run on tiny charges, too. A chemical called acetylcholine allows the charge to pass when you need to move, and when you want to stop, another chemical, cholinesterase, is manufactured. Cholinesterase destroys acetylcholine, so your nerves become poor conductors again. Good thing, too. Otherwise, once you started scratching your nose, you'd never be able to stop. Okay. The point is this. Everything you think, everything you do, it all has to run off the battery, like the accessories in a car. They were all still listening closely. Watching TV, reading books, talking with friends, eating a big dinner, all of it runs off the battery. A normal life, at least in what used to be Western civilization, is like running a car with power windows, power brakes, power seats, all the goodies. But the more goodies you have, the less the battery can charge. True? Yeah, Ralph said. Even a big Delco won't ever overcharge while it's sitting in a Cadillac. Well, what we've done is to strip off the accessories. We're on charge. Ralph said uneasily, if you put a car battery on charge for too long, she'll explode. Yes, Glenn agreed, same with people. You can clean yourself out so much there's nothing left. The Bible tells us about Isaiah and Job and the others, but it doesn't say how many prophets came back from the wilderness with visions that had crisped their brains. I imagine there were some. But I have a healthy respect for human intelligence and the human psyche, in spite of an occasional throwback like East Texas here. Off my case, Baldy, Stu growled. Anyhow, the capacity of the human mind is a lot bigger than the biggest Delco battery. I think it can take a charge almost to infinity. In certain cases, perhaps beyond infinity. They walked in silence for a while, thinking this over. Are we changing? Stu asked quietly. Yes, Glenn answered. Yes, I think we are. We've dropped some weight, Ralph said. I know that just looking at you guys. And me, I used to have a hell of a beer gut. Now I can look down and see my toes again. It's a state of mind, Larry said suddenly. When they looked at him, he seemed a trifle embarrassed, but went on. I've had this feeling for the last week or so, and I couldn't understand it. Maybe now I can. I've been feeling high, like I'd done half a joint of really dynamite grass or snorted just a touch of coke. But there's none of the disorienting feeling that goes with dope. You do some dope and you feel like normal thinking is just a little bit out of your grasp. I feel like I'm thinking just fine, better than ever, in fact. But I still feel high. Larry laughed. Maybe it's just hunger. Hunger's part of it, Glenn agreed, but not all of it. Me, I'm hungry all the time, Ralph said. But it doesn't seem too important. I feel good. I do too, Stu said. Physically, I haven't felt this good in years. When you empty out the vessel, you also empty out all the crap floating around in there, Glenn said. The additives, the impurities. Sure, it feels good. It's a whole body, whole mind enema. You got such a fancy way of putting things, Baldy. It may be inelegant, but it's accurate. Ralph asked, will it help us with him? Well, Glenn said, that's what it's for. I don't have much doubt about that. But we'll just have to wait and see, won't we? They came to the washout a little past noon on the 23rd. The sky had been overcast all day, and it was cold. Cold enough to snow, almost, Stu thought. The four of them stood on the edge, Kojak at Glenn's heel, looking down and across. Somewhere north of here, a dam might have given way, or there might have been a succession of hard summer rainstorms. Whatever, there had been a flash flood along the San Rafael, which was only a dry wash in some years. It had swept away a great 30-foot slab of I-70. The gully was about 50 feet deep, the banks crumbly, rubbly soil and sedimentary rock. At the bottom was a sullen trickle of water. Holy crow, Ralph said. Somebody ought to call the Utah State Highway Department about this. Larry pointed. Look over there, he said. They looked out into the monolith-strewn wilderness, and about 100 yards down the course of the San Rafael, they saw a tangle of guardrails and cable, and large slabs of asphalt composition paving. One chunk stuck up toward the cloudy, racing sky like an apocalyptic finger, complete with the white, broken passing line. Glenn was looking down into the rubble-strewn cut, hands stuffed into his pockets, an absent, dreaming look on his face. In a low voice, Stu said, "Can you make it, Glenn?"
"Sure, I think so."
"How's that arthritis?"
"It's been worse," he cracked a smile. "But in all honesty, it's been better, too."
They had no rope with which to anchor each other. Stu went down first, moving carefully. He didn't like the way the ground sometimes shifted under his feet, starting little slides of rock and dirt. Once he thought his footing was going to go out from under him completely, sending him sliding all the way to the bottom on his can. One groping hand caught a solid rock outcropping, and he hung on for dear life, finding more solid ground for his feet. Then Kojak was bounding blithely past him, kicking up little puffs of dirt and sending down only small runnels of earth. A moment later, he was standing on the bottom, wagging his tail and barking amiably up at Stu.
"Fucking show-off dog," Stu growled, and carefully made his way to the bottom.
"I'm coming next," Glenn called. "I heard what you said about my dog."
"Be careful, Baldy. Be damn careful. It's really loose underfoot."
Glenn came down slowly, moving with great deliberation from one hold to the next. Stu tensed every time he saw loose dirt start to slide out from underneath Glenn's battered Georgia Giants. His hair blew like fine silver around his ears in the light breeze that had sprung up. It occurred to him that when he had first met Glenn, painting a mediocre picture beside the road in New Hampshire, Glenn's hair had still been mostly dark. Until the moment Glenn finally planted his feet on the level ground of the mud flat at the bottom of the gully, Stu was sure he was going to fall and break himself in two. Stu sighed with relief and clapped him on the shoulder.
"No sweat, East Texas," Glenn said, and bent to ruffle Kojak's fur.
"Plenty here," Stu told him. Ralph came next, jumping the last 8 feet or so.
"Boy," he said, "that shit's just as loose as a goose. Be funny if we couldn't get up that other bank and had to walk 4 or 5 miles upstream to find shallower bank, wouldn't it?"
"Be a lot funnier if another flash flood came along while we were looking," Stu said. Larry came down agilely and well, joining them less than 3 minutes after they had started down.
"Who goes up first?" he asked.
"Why don't you, since you're so perky?" Glenn said.
"Sure."
It took him considerably longer to get up, and twice the treacherous footing ran out beneath him, and he nearly fell. But finally he gained the top and waved down at them.
"I'm next," Glenn said, and walked across to the other bank.
Stu caught his arm. "Listen," he said, "we can walk upstream and find a shallower bank, like Ralph said,
and lose the rest of the day. When I was a kid, I could have gone up there in 40 seconds and registered a pulse rate under 70 at the top."
"You're no kid now, Glenn."
"No, but I think there's still some of him left."
Before Stu could say more, Glenn had started up. He paused to rest about a third of the way up and then pressed on. Near the halfway point, he grabbed an outcrop of shale that crumbled away under his hands, and Stu was sure he was going to tumble all the way to the bottom, end over arthritic end.
"Ah, shit," Ralph breathed.
Glenn flailed his arms and somehow kept his balance. He jigged to his right and went up another 20 feet, rested, then went up again. Near the top, a spur of rock that he had been standing on tore loose, and he would have fallen, but Larry was there. He grabbed Glenn's arm and hauled him up.
"Nothing to it," Glenn called down.
Stu grinned with relief.
"How's your pulse rate, Baldy?"
"Plus 90, I think," Glenn admitted.
Ralph went up like a stolid mountain goat, checking each hold, shifting his hands and feet with great deliberation. When he reached the top, Stu started up. Right up until the moment he fell, Stu was thinking that actually this slope was a little easier than the one they had descended. The holds were better, the gradient a tiny bit shallower. But the surface was a mixture of chalky soil and rock fragments that had been badly loosened by the wet weather. Stu sensed that it wanted to be evil, and he went up carefully. His chest was over the edge, when the knob of outcropping his left foot was on suddenly disappeared. He felt himself begin to slide. Larry grabbed for his hand, but this time he missed his grip. Stu grabbed the outjutting edge of the turnpike, and it came off in his hands. He stared at it stupidly for a moment as the speed of his descent began to increase. He discarded it, feeling insanely like the coyote in a Roadrunner cartoon. His knee struck something, and there was a sudden bolt of pain. He grabbed at the gluey surface of the slope, which was now speeding past him at an alarming rate, and kept coming away with nothing but handfuls of dirt. He slammed into a boulder and cartwheeled. The breath slapped from his body. He fell free for about 10 feet and came down on his lower leg at an angle. He heard it snap. The pain was instantaneous and huge. He yelled. He did a backward somersault. He was eating dirt now. Sharp pebbles scrawled bloody scratches across his face and arms. He came down on his hurt leg again and felt it snap somewhere else. This time he didn't yell. This time he screamed. He slid the last 15 feet on his belly like a kid on a greasy shoot the chute. He came to rest with his pants full of mud and his heart beating crazily in his ears. The leg was white fire. Broken, but how bad? Pretty bad from the way it feels. 2 places at least, maybe more. And the knees sprung. Then Larry was coming down the slope, moving in lithe jumps that seemed almost a mockery of what had just happened to Stu. Then he was kneeling beside him, asking the question which Stu had already asked himself. How bad, Stu? Stu got up on his elbows and looked at Larry, his face white with shock and streaked brown with dirt. I figure I'll be walking again in about 3 months, he said. He began to feel as if he was going to puke. He looked up at the cloudy sky, balled his fists up, and shook them at it.
Oh, shit! He screamed.
Ralph and Larry splinted the leg. Glenn had produced a bottle of arthritis pills and gave Stu one. Stu didn't know what was in the arthritis pills, and Glenn refused to say, but the pain in his leg faded to a faraway drone. He felt very calm, even serene. It occurred to him that they were all living on borrowed time, not because they were on their way to find Flag necessarily, but because they had survived Captain Tripp's in the first place. At any rate, he knew what had to be done, and he was going to see that it was done. Larry had just finished speaking. They all looked at him anxiously to see what he would say. What he said was simple enough. No. Stu, Glenn said gently, you don't understand.
I understand. I'm saying no. No trip back to Green River. No rope, no car. Against the rules of the game.
It's no fucking game, Larry cried. You die here.
And you're almost surely going to die over there in Nevada. Now go on and get getting. You've got another 4 hours of daylight.
We're not going to leave you, Larry said. I'm sorry, but you are. I'm telling you to.
No, I'm in charge now. Mother said if anything happened to you, that you were to go on.
No, no.
Larry looked around at Glenn and Ralph for support. They looked back at him, troubled. Kojak sat nearby, watching all four.
Listen to me, Larry, Stu said. This whole trip is based on the idea that the old lady knew what she was talking about. If you start frigging around with that, you're putting everything on the line.
Yeah, that's right, Ralph said.
No, it ain't right, you sod buster, Larry said, furiously mimicking Ralph's flat Oklahoma accent. It wasn't God's will that Stu fell down here. It wasn't even the dark man's doing. It was just loose dirt, that's all, just loose dirt. I'm not leaving you, Stu. I'm done leaving people behind.
Yes, we are going to leave him, Glenn said quietly.
Larry stared around unbelievingly.
I thought you were his friend.
I am, but that doesn't matter. Larry uttered a hysterical laugh and walked a little way down the gully.
You're crazy, you know that?